Thank you for being here. I see some faces from yesterday. I'm glad I didn't scare you off with the abstract conceptual theory stuff. I'm a theory guy. So I like to have conversations that have some structure, which is what I was trying to do yesterday. Today my hope is to turn you all into bioethicists. I'm gonna give you a case. It's on genetics. And actually have you work in groups and maybe pretend you are in a church committee of, let's say, a bioethical church committee, and you have to sort of respond to the case study. What would you tell the church community in terms of what they would do within the particular case? So we're gonna watch a DVD for that kind of case. And there's a couple other ones if we get through this one too, so depending on what time we have and whatnot. But just to recap sort of very briefly what we talked about yesterday, in terms of foundational Christian ideas about the value of human life. And part of it relates to the belief that all of us are created in the image of God. And because we're created in the image of God, we are essentially relational creatures. Primarily, we try to relate to God. We are also equal. All of us have that image of God. No matter our capacities, no matter our intellect, no matter our abilities, everyone has that. It also asks us to be good stewards of creation. It's one of the controversial interpretations of the idea of the image of God, because the word is dominion, often in English, which is sort of often been translated as something that one has lordship over creation. Secondly, we have sin, which problematizes that image. That image in some ways is distorted in us. We don't clearly know that image of God. We can't clearly express it. We clearly aren't relating to God in the way that we should be. And there are consequences because of sin. We, though, and this is especially within the Protestant tradition, also have an idea of God, that God created everything. And because God created everything, creation is good. The problem, or the difficulty that comes, and that's still being worked out today in theological circles, is where does human creativity fit in? And that's what I want to discuss today. Because human creativity includes culture. Culture is something we, for the most part, have created, art. But also this fancy word, technology. Technology comes from the Greek, it just means making. Art or craft. So thinking about the art and craft of making things. So we use technology, obviously, in a highly sort of specialized way. That projector, the DVD player. Most of you, I was at Holden in the early 90s, and the internet was in its infancy. And now I can't imagine my life without the internet. Email, cell phones. I mean, sort of funny that this is a DVD. You won't see this part, but parts of it were taken in 1999. And there's a guy in a cell phone. And the cell phone's like this big. And he pulls it out. He's got to flip it open, pull out the antenna. All of us are sort of laughing because, you know, cell phones now could fit in our pocket. So then you have the iPhone. But part of what technology is, especially when it comes to bioethical issues, technology envisions the way life should be. If we think about, for instance, genetics, and this is partially the root of, for instance, the Human Genome Project. Anyone know, familiar with the Human Genome Project? Anyone want to talk about it, or should I?
Yeah. Well, it is one of the ways that we're talking about eradicating diseases by removing them from the DNA of people, of humanity, by engineering that out.
Exactly. Humans, I'm sure this is Bio 101, that humans are basically built off a parts list. And the parts list is DNA. DNA tell protein how to develop. Humans have approximately 30,000 genes in their body. A fruit fly has 14,000. Which suggests that we're actually not that far removed from fruit fly. Humans, genetically, are 99.9% the same. There's only a 0.1% difference between all of us.
genetically.
The Human Genome Project was started in 1990 by the U.S. federal government to map all the genes in the body, hoping that a great number of sort of health improvements could come from that genetic mapping. And right now, they're not exactly sure what possibilities are. They're still working it out. But it was finished in 2003, and they mapped out the whole genetic code, the whole parts list of the human being. And that's what this DVD is about. And with sort of that human creativity comes with the idea that we should all be perfectly healthy. We should get rid of Alzheimer's and diabetes, and spina bifida, and Tay-Sachs, which is an inherited disease. We can then engineer the future human such that that human is free from certain types of diseases that we know now. Sort of the goal. So the, to me, that's a very creative act. They want to both create, but they're also envisioning what that future human will look like. That's where we get into tricky issues. Even in the 1930s, there were many laws in many states that prevented mentally retarded people from reproducing. The belief was is that if you were developmentally disabled, then you reproduce with someone else that was developmentally disabled. Guess what? You'd have a developmentally disabled child. It was illegal to reproduce. And many Christian denominations supported that, sort of controlled eugenics. So, you have a question?
Well, I was going to say, is health then considered, is it a right? You know, in the bioethical and the genome community to say that removing disease and disabilities would be an expectation that we should all hold to, that it becomes part of the good.
That's the kind of issue I'm hoping we can talk about today. Today is, my goal again, is to turn you all into bioethicists the rest of the week. So with that, because of sin, and because we have this creative power that in many ways is ambiguous, we can do things, we can create nuclear reactors, but we can also build bombs. Same sort of technology, the same type of making gives us good things, but also evil potentials, shall we say. So we have to have some value, and for Christians, the value comes from the idea of Christ. Christ, within the Christian story, tells us what? Tells us love of neighbor is what we are supposed to be doing in all of our actions. We're supposed to seek the end of suffering, not just of Christians, but everyone who is equally imaged with God because of the image God in there. But, and I talked about this yesterday, because of sort of the way we as contemporary Western American Christians, we don't live, let's say, in a perfect Christian world. And frankly, being Lutheran, the Lutheran tradition says we never will. We're sort of stuck. We're stuck between God's kingdom and the prince's kingdom. Luther has this idea of the two kingdoms. And so what I was doing yesterday was coming up with a number of different ways just for us to think about different kinds of values. And I don't think these are unique to Christianity. There's certainly a great, you don't have to be Christians to have, let's say, a good bioethic. However, because Holden's Christian and I'm a Lutheran ethicist, what I'm tasked doing, at least for us, is to think about, in many ways, what do these ideas tell us about how we're supposed to interact with these two sort of tensions. And I think there is no perfect answer. I also think that these aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. You know, can you be both focused as an individual and be part of a community? That's what bioethicists, that's what ethicists work out, is kind of those tensions. And so what I'd like for us to do, and we'll watch this DVD now, is just think about how you would respond to the question posed by the narrator. And the sequence of events we'll watch is that there's a family, that three sisters, one of them has been killed by cancer, the other one developed cancer, was genetically tested. And when she was genetically tested, she discovered she had a problem with her genes. this problem gives her a greater probability of developing ovarian or breast cancer. Well, she has two kids. They're not sure if they want to be tested. And what I want you to think about, and what I'd like us to talk about after the video, is pretend again that you're... I don't even know if most churches have, like, bioethics committees, but pretend you actually are the leading instigator of one in your church or community. What advice would you give to that community in terms of, is genetic testing such that you would know your probability of future diseases, is that a good? That's something that is a gift of God that helps us better relate to God, that helps us better image God in us. Does it end suffering? Does it lead towards justice? Or is it more problematic than that? And that's what I'd like to talk about after the video is over. Any questions? Make sense? So, can you turn off the light again?
One rather bleak vision of where all this could lead is presented in the Hollywood film Gattaca. This is a world where everybody's DNA, everybody's future diary, is an open book. Everyone who can afford to has their children made to spec, but what happens to the poor slob who was conceived the old-fashioned way?
I'll never understand what possessed my mother to put her faith in God's hands rather than those of her local geneticist. 10 fingers, 10 toes, that's all that used to matter. Not now. Now, only seconds old, the exact time and cause of my death was already known.
Neurological condition, 60% probability. Attention deficit disorder, 89% probability. Heart disorder, 99% probability. Life expectancy, 30.2 years.
30.2 years. The nurse seems to know precisely what's going to happen to this baby, which is ridiculous, right? Never happened. Or is it possible that one day we will be able to look with disturbing clarity into our future 10, 20, even 70 years ahead?
That is one possible future, where this becomes so routine that at birth, everybody gets a profile that goes right to their medical record. One copy goes to the FBI, so we have an identification system for all possible crimes in the United States. One copy goes where? To the grade school, to the high school, to the college, to the employer, to the military. Like a horrific future. Although I have to say there are many in the biotech industry and the medical profession who think that's a terrific future.
In fact, a lot of the technology already exists now, today. These guys in the funny suits are making gene chips. The little needles are dropping tiny, nearly invisible bits of DNA onto glass slides. And where did the DNA come from? From babies, thousands of them. Each chip can support 80,000 different DNA tests.
So a single chip, in principle, will allow you to test, say, 1,000 babies for 80 different human diseases. So within a few minutes, you can have a readout for thousands or even tens of thousands of babies in a single experiment.
Already, babies are routinely tested for a handful of diseases, but with gene chips, everybody could be tested for hundreds of conditions.
Knowing is great, knowing early is even better, and that's really what the technology allows us to do.
Well, taking a test and knowing is great for the baby, anybody really, as long as there's something you can do about it.
But think about this, because sometimes there may be a test, but it might take 20 years or 50 years, 50 years to find a cure. So you could take the test and you could learn that there is a disease coming your way, but you can't do anything about it. Do you still want to know? Or you could take the test, but the test won't say that you're going to get the disease. It'll simply say that you may get a disease. And as you know, there is a big difference between you will and you may.
I mean, it's just now feels like...
Lissa Kaplis and Lori Siegel are sisters who shared the wrenching experience of cancer in the family. Way back, there were three sisters, and then in 1979, the youngest of the three, Melanie, was diagnosed with ovarian cancer.
Well, when my sister was diagnosed, my response was disbelief. She was 30 years old, and I'd never known anybody of that age to have ovarian cancer.
Melanie fought her cancer for 4 years, but died in 1983. It seemed an isolated piece of bad luck, but then just about a year later, Lissa discovered that she had breast cancer. She was only 34, but the cancer hadn't spread, so the long-term outlook seemed optimistic.
I actually had a radiation therapist who was tops in the field, wrote many books on breast cancer, and was very optimistic. What I remember him saying is that he and I would grow old together.
And Lissa was fine for 12 years. And then she found another lump in the same breast.
It was the worst fear come true. The first time I could hold on to hope. The second time nobody was talking with me about living to be old.
When Lissa discovered her second cancer in 1996, scientists were just beginning to work out the link between breast and ovarian cancers that run in families. Mary Claire King was one of the scientists who discovered that changes or mutations in two specific genes make a woman's risk of breast and ovarian cancer much higher. The genes are called BRCA1 and 2.
BRCA1 and BRCA2 are perfectly healthy, normal genes that all of us have. But in a few families, mutations in these genes are inherited.
So in a normal gene, so we're going to spell it out for you here, letter by letter, this is the normal sequence ending G, T, A, G, C, A, G, T. Now we're going to make a copy. And we're going to lose two of the letters, just two, and then see, watch them shift over. You see that? This new configuration is a mutation which can often cause breast cancer.
In the United States and Western Europe and Canada, the risk of developing breast cancer for women in the population as a whole is about 10% over the course of her lifetime, with, of course, most of that risk occurring later in her life. For a woman with a mutation in BRCA1 or BRCA2, the lifetime risk of breast cancer is about 80%. It's very high.
Right around the time of Lissa's second bout of breast cancer, a test for BRCA mutations became available. Lissa and her sister Lori decided to be tested.
I do remember the day that I went to find out the results. Panic, terror. I mean, what was I going to find out? Talking about, you know, the blood surging through your temples. I mean, I just remember sheer terror.
Turns out Lori was fine, but Lissa discovered that she does carry a BRCA mutation. It is not easy waking up every morning wondering if today's the day you may get sick.
Any questions about the results from the biopsy from April?
No questions about the results. Again, it feels like often my life is dodging bullets.
With the second cancer, Lissa had her right breast completely removed and then another operation to take out her ovaries.
Okay, just keep tight
fist. She also has a high risk of cancer in her left breast. BRCA mutations are relatively rare and only cause maybe 5 or 10% of all breast cancer. But note that there's a BRCA mutation in the family affects everybody.
The gene doesn't go away. The time passed since the last cancer doesn't buy you the safety. And the consequences run through the family. And I suppose that for my daughter, who it has not shown any significant impact of this, the knowledge that there's a genetic component that she can't deny, will, I'm sure, color her life in serious ways.
Lissa's son, Justin, is 21. Her daughter, Alana, is 18. There is a 50-50 chance that each of them has inherited the BRCA mutation from Lissa. The only way to know would be to take a test. And when should they do that? When is the right time?
I actually never really thought about it until biology this year, when my teacher posed a hypothetical, supposedly, question to people saying, what would you do? Can you imagine what you would do if you were faced with a situation where you knew that you might have this disease that would be deadly, or it would cause you to be sick, and you could do a test and you could find out whether or not you had it. And I was sitting there in class saying, maybe it's not so hypothetical.
And then in her senior year of high school, Alana felt a lump in her own breast.
I did have the whole, oh, it can't be happening to me, not yet, kind of thing. I mean, I have the reservation in the back of my mind that eventually it may very well happen to me, and if it does, then I'll fight it then, I'll deal with it then. But I don't expect, or I definitely didn't expect for this to be happening to me when I'm 17 years old.
Alana's lump was not cancer, and for now she doesn't want the test, because if she knew that she had the bad gene, she'd only have two options, the choice of removing her breasts and ovaries to try to reduce her risk, or just to be closely monitored and wait.
She's followed every year. Seems a little young to, have her have to face that. On the other hand, it also feels like the belt and suspenders technique, and to do everything we can do.
In the next 20 years, this family's predicament will become more and more common as more and more genes are linked to more and more diseases and more tests become available. But we will all have to ask, do we want to know? And when we know, can we live with an answer that says, maybe, but maybe not?
Driving home from work today, I was tuned into public radio, and there was a professor of astronomy talking about a brand new telescope to look into the galaxies. And they're calling it the equivalent of the Human Genome Project. And I was thinking, not quite the equivalent of the Human Genome Project, because it's without some of the ethical, moral, angst, real people issues, where it's a bit of a roller coaster ride between, this is going to hold answers and hope and treatments and interventions and cure, versus it's not clear what this all means.
And if things aren't clear now, what about the future, when we may not only cure disease, but do so much more?
Your extracted eggs, Marie, have been... They'll stop.
You turn the lights on, please. So, do you want to know? Yeah.
This is so ironic. I have a good friend whose daughter is having major surgery tomorrow at the University of Minnesota Hospital because she has that mutation.
Oh.
And it's in that family. There's various, relatives that have had breast cancer and so on. And so then some of them have opted to be tested and some haven't. But the males can be carriers of this, apparently.
Yeah, it does sound like it affects males, or at least not in the same way it affects women. But,
the daughter that's having the surgery is, she'll be 40 this year. I don't know exactly when her birthday is. And they discovered her breast cancer just almost by accident, because she had some swollen lymph nodes, on the right side, for instance. So they did a mammogram and then discovered the cancer on the other side. The lymph nodes were just incidental to something else that was going on. So she is having bilateral mastectomy, and then the ovaries also are going, and apparently when they do the surgery to remove the ovaries, it has to be done in a certain way preferably by a gynecological oncologist, because it has to be a certain procedure, and they do washings and whatever to get all the cells out of there. So, I mean, this is just ironic to even be talking about this when this is, you know, going on tomorrow.
Ricky?
Would you like us to pray for her? No?
Certainly.
What's her name?
Sandy. Sandy.
And how should, what's her relationship?
Her mother and I are good friends.
Okay, we're nice. Is there someone that would like to offer up a prayer? Oh, okay. Dear God, we ask for your guidance and love and blessing on Sandy tomorrow, and on the doctor who will be performing the surgery on her, give her strength and guide the doctor. And for your love, we Jesus' name.
Any other quick responses or quick, yeah, Jenny?
I was thinking, I mean, I don't know whether I would want to know or not yet, and that's something to sort out. I wonder whether the availability of the test changes that much. I mean, if you were in a family where your mother and your aunt had both had serious breast cancer and you were a young girl, whether you knew an exact percentage or not, you would assume that was at least potentially looming in your future. And you would constantly wonder whether you were going to get it or not. So in some ways, this is posed as though the test has caused this quandary for them. And it kind of has, but I think it's a quandary they would be having anyway. They've got enough women in their family who has had breast cancer. You would be concerned about your daughter, whether she was tested or not.
That is true. It, when you meet a doctor, they often go, what's your family history? Do you have a family history? Like, Kata, my wife, when we went for prenatal exams, they asked us a number of questions about, you know, what was your birth weight, what was this, to try and establish some type of family history so they could predict what the pregnancy might happen. Just one response to that, though. I do think that there is a difference, though, between, and I think this is what the video is suggesting, you can quibble with me on this or not. Do we trust medicine men? Do we trust science so much that there's a distinction between here's your genes, and it's so certain that there's a different sort of value and emphasis on our trust of science versus sort of, well, you know, my grandmother had this, and you know, I do think that one of the tensions we all experience is the fact that, you know, science and medicine, in a lot of ways, have sort of, and this is sort of a contentious, morphed into the territory that historically had been sort of the territory of religion and spirit and whatnot. So the issue is, most of us, and when you have conversations, we trust our doctors.
Right, but we're still given choices.
Sometimes.
It's when people make decisions for us, it's difficult.
Say more about that, I'm not quite clear.
Well, I mean, I believe I would have it, if I was to take a test, it would be my choice if I wanted to take it. I mean, I like their options there. I mean, they had, you know, they could raise a family, you know, have kids, but be tested all the time. I mean, we do regular visits with our doctors. I mean,
it's just to do it or not. Yes.
Two things. First, related to the comment about family history, I'm curious as to whether one could find a surgeon who would do a preventive mastectomy on the basis of family history without some
That's a good point.
Finding. Right. And second, I believe in many of these cases it's a misapplication of statistics to apply them to an individual case. Statistics are a way we work with groups of numbers. And all of the 80% figure tells one is that I belong in a group where 80% of the people are very likely to come down with this. It says nothing about my chance. I don't have an 80% chance. I either have 100% chance or no chance. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm a scientist, basically, and I would go ahead and have the test done
if I were in that family situation. And then I think what you just said is accurate. Would I seek out that doctor that would do the preventive mastectomy and all of that? No, I probably wouldn't. But maybe instead of going once a year for a physical, I'd go every 6 months. And I would keep a watch on it because I would still have a 20%, even though it's 100% or nothing, I would still have a 20% chance statistically of not having the concern. So I think the ethics comes in more, would you do something to prevent something that may never happen?
Well, I also think the ethics come into play because of, I think, of this tension. You know, and part of the issue is medical costs and treatments. And for instance, if you, the cost of cancer treatments are quite expensive and hospital visits. So if you know ahead of time, I mean, we are in a world of risk, but we also have actuaries who tell us how much we're supposed to pay because of our gender, our family history. You know, I always think of auto insurance. You know, all of a sudden, once you're married, your auto insurance rates go down. Because in theory, you're less risky. You're not a risky male.
So I've got to reiterate my pool. It's not because you're less risky. It's because you're in a pool of people where the risk is less.
Yeah, but the society
it's a group
sees
number
us.
That the actuaries
sure.
work with.
Sure, but we're in some ways we don't have as many choices, I think, as we would because we have insurance companies. We have a sort of an economic system that works with risk, and they want to quantify risk. And by the way, quantify risk with statistics based on where you are within a segment of the population. And that affects the types of choices that we have. They quantify us. I mean, you go in there and they have a little table that's what's your age, what's your family history. That's where you get sort of a risk assessment. So I agree with you, but at the same time, culturally, we sort of not as free as most of us would want to be in terms of choices.
Well, I guess all I'm trying to drive home is the point that it's a logical fallacy to apply those numbers on an individual basis.
Yet our culture does.
Absolutely, all the time. But it's not the actuaries that are doing it. They're applying it on a group basis.
Any other quick comment? Yeah.
There's a couple things that I was thinking about with this, and one is that at the heart of this, it seems like we just want to do whatever we can to avoid suffering, and that as a culture, we view all suffering as bad and to be avoided at all costs. And I'm not saying that people should be doomed to cancer because it's good for their soul or something like that, but that maybe part of it is just that we are scared of any kind of suffering, and that we don't also take into account what can come from that that might be good or that we can learn from it. And that's, I don't have an answer to where you draw that line, but I think that's just an interesting part of our culture, that, you know, we just don't want any suffering at all. We want our lives to be perfect. But the other thing I was thinking about was, I wonder if it would change if the disease was something that wasn't cancer, that they were testing for it. Like, in my family, my father and all his siblings and his mother all have had diabetes. And so I'm looking at my life saying, you know, I genetically probably have a pretty good chance that that's, if I don't watch myself, that that's, even if I do watch myself and what I do in my life, that that's coming down the road. But it doesn't scare me the same way that cancer does. Like, cancer is very charged in my mind, and I think in our culture, that cancer is just an immediate death sentence, and it's horrible treatments that you have to suffer through. And but something like diabetes, it's like, well, I'm not going to get tested for that because
the consequences,
it's something
aren't
that you
great.
Just live with. And but cancer, I don't know if I and I wouldn't, and I think for each person, what are they going to do with that information, and what kind of support do they have to help them deal with that? I don't know that a lot of people have the support to help them through that process of once you do know how that changes your life. And,
so. I have a question, a further question to you. What do you mean by suffering?
I think saying that we know, okay, like the woman says, I have this breast cancer mutation, and I have a friend who did the same thing, where she had cancer once, she got tested, she found she had the mutation, so she had both of her breasts completely removed because she didn't want the cancer. Because the cancer was worse, or the threat of cancer was worse than having both her breasts removed. And so the suffering was from cancer and the treatment and the possibility of death and all the things that you have to go through when you're being treated for cancer. And that, yes, it's horrible, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody, and yet we just see it all as bad. It's evil, it needs to leave. And I think that's true with anything, any kind of illness, or but maybe cancer's a little more emotional for us.
Well, the reason I ask that is, do you remember the husband? What would you characterize his comments about his wife's predicament?
He sure looked pretty sad.
Do you think he's suffering, even if he doesn't have? I mean, I think there's an interesting kind of tension over the idea of suffering here. I mean, certainly cancer is, you know, my grandfather died of anaplastic thyroid cancer. He went like this. He was healthy one day, went in, found a huge tumor in his neck, and died within about 8 months, and he suffered. You know, just to watch him go from a healthy 80-year-old to sort of a skinny 80-year-old was hard for me. And clearly he suffered physically, and obviously there's a spiritual suffering there too, but is there a suffering that comes with knowing that there's a great probability that you're going to die of something at some point? Meaning your whole life sort of, and your attitude about how you lived your life. I mean, I've known people that have almost died, and a lot of them live sort of materialistically. I'm going to have as much fun in the world as I can have, because that's what this world's all about, and I've suffered enough. And it changes how they value things, I think. And I'm just wondering, you know, what is there, this might sound like a strange question, is there, which type of suffering do you think is greater? I mean, you sort of think that there's almost a spiritual element, I think, that brings you maybe closer to God, maybe helps you become a better person, sort of helps you grow religiously.
It can.
So.
I don't think it necessarily, I don't think everybody gets to that point. And maybe that's what is hard, is that I know when I've had suffering that I wasn't automatically this spiritual person all of a sudden. It took me a lot of help to be able to kind of reap some benefit, whatever I could, from a horrible situation. And I don't mean that I should just embrace every suffering that comes along, because see, this is where I don't know where the tension is. There is good that can come from suffering. I think that we ignore that part of it, and we just say we should end all suffering. And cancer is a horrible suffering, and it is. It's horrible. And my husband had it, and it's like, I don't want that for anybody. But do we just say that everybody should not be allowed the choice, or
for the lesser of two evils?
Yeah. To pick up on that, I mean, I think one of the, I'm doing a risky thing of quoting another religion, but I believe one of the tenets of Buddhism is that life is suffering.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And I think I might disagree with your number four, suffering. That Christ is about suffering to end suffering. Instead, I might interpret Christ more to say that Christ is about suffering with people. And so I understand, I agree 100% what you're saying. Once again, I don't wish suffering on anyone, but I think if the goal in life is to end all, but we think life's about ending suffering, we're just not being realistic. Because I also find, you know, we've all of us said it, you know, this might lead to death. Well, guess what?
The only certainty in life is death.
Yeah, and obviously, it's better if we, you know, die of ripe old ages kind of thing.
But it's not as if we just line things up right, we're going to avoid this. We can't avoid death. I'm not sure we can avoid suffering. I'm not sure the Christian vision of life is a life without suffering. It's somehow, how do we care for one another in the midst of that? How do we find meaning in it? Once again, this doesn't mean that God creates suffering or wants suffering, but it just is, I think. I think if we focus our whole energy in saying there should be no suffering, and I'm thinking of it as a parent too. How often as parents do we let our kids suffer some things because it is the only way they're going to learn and grow and develop? It doesn't make us monsters. It makes us people who are realizing the reality of suffering in the world. And if we totally shelter our kids from it, we're not preparing them to be whole human beings.
I have younger kids, and my husband, they're not overdramatic. You know, they get a scrape or their muscles are sore. And my husband's mantra is always, life is not pain-free. You know, you're going to have some pain in life. It's not, you can't just go through all happy about everything.
Let me just say one thing in sort of response. I mean, part of it has to do again with, and I'll use this one, the material. You know, the material focuses on the physical body. And the spirit's obviously sort of the soul or the spirit, however you want to define that. And I'm not trying to right now, but there has been a tendency within the Christian tradition to be over here, for sure. Partially because where is the true home for Christians? It's not in the whole village, it's in heaven.
Right.
So there's a devaluation historically, which you still see in certain forms of theology, that sort of de-emphasized material. And within the last 50 years, there's been a lot of work done by feminist theologians who have tried to reclaim the body as the center of doing and thinking about God's presence on the earth. That we have to value the body sort of equally as a reaction to sort of this avertiveness of saying that it's really spiritual suffering that really matters. Physical suffering, you sort of mortify the flesh so that you can get to that true, sort of closer spiritual connection to God. And you see this in Luther. Luther, every day, he had inner struggles. The German is Anfechtungen. And he just believed that the real issue of sin was the fact that our love is screwed up. We should love God, but instead we love ourselves. And so, consequently, he spiritually suffered. And the way he would find the end of suffering, because he defined suffering as sort of a spiritual inner way of being, that the way you end it is trusting in God's promise that you are still made right with God, despite the fact that you can never do, you can never become righteous on your own. And that's sort of where this focus on suffering. So there's a focus on spiritual suffering, which is partially why I asked, you know, there's obviously the horrific physical suffering. But you also have, sort of in bioethics, if you're going to focus on ending suffering, what kind of suffering are you really trying to end? Are you trying to end the daughter clearly is conflicted in our particular case study. She isn't sure what she should do because, to me, it sounds like she's worried. You know, am I going to be determined? Am I not going to have any freedom? And for Luther and sort of the basis of Lutheran ethics, you want to be freed from those sufferings. You free and then you can love. In response, you're not trapped in your own. I'm so worried. Will God make me right? So the issue then is, you know, again, where do you fall in that kind of continuum?
Yeah. I don't think this discussion over if they should take the test or not really involves stopping their suffering. The suffering with their breast cancer is already, those cards have been played. That exists. The reason that it's obviously ethical that you take the test is so that the daughter can make wise choices, so she can know if she has that mutation, does she go on with her life normally? Does she reproduce? Does she do those things? That's why I think it's obviously ethical that you take the test.
So you think she should take it?
Yeah, she's, because it'll affect how she lives her life. She can, somebody over here said, take mammograms more regularly. I don't think, the suffering, she's not eliminating suffering by taking the test, she's just filling in the gaps to know how she can best go about living her life.
Okay.
Where does this information end up, though? So I'm not tested, I have a probability or whatever. I am tested, and suddenly, somewhere on some chart, someone knows that I have this 80% chance that I'm going to develop breast cancer, how does that affect how I go through this continuum of healthcare throughout my life, and who has that information and that knowledge?
That's something all of us are sort of scared of, you know, losing your healthcare coverage and not being able to get health coverage because of a pre-existing condition. Pre-existing, is that one? That's two words, I suppose. I mean, the two most heard words right now.
I think my point relates to birds.
I'm sorry.
Well, I've been diabetic for 35 years. Uh-huh. And so obviously, juvenile onset. My grandmother was diabetic, and so I know that, and it generally, diabetes is generation skipping, and that so that all of her children faced the ethical question about having children. Most have not developed diabetes, but they do know that they also carry the mutation or whatever, and so that I probably have 40 nieces and nephews, and so that all of them, and second nieces, so all of them, the people of my generation have also wrestled with that issue. Now, so that it showed up in my family. My younger sister contracted diabetes earlier than I did, so that the one thing that we knew was that it was in the family, and so that when I developed diabetes, they knew right away what to do. And so as a result, I've gone, because we identified it so soon, there were fewer effects. And so that I have been relatively healthy throughout my life, and my sister has not. So that's the good side about knowing it. But there's also that deep emotional struggle with what to do personally, that what human agency. So I know that that how I live my life has a great impact, not only on myself but on my family and others. And so then for me, there was the question of whether or not to have children was, you know, a very intentional and involved conversation, even before we got married. You know, you had to come clean with that. So that is, I mean, the risk is, the reality of that is that you do have to identify that. It also affects in terms of insurability and career and movement and all of those things, you know, so that as we know more and more about what things are in our bodies that can cause struggles and difficulties like this, it will influence and affect the way we live lives. And I can tell you personally that I have been at times in my life extremely aware of my mortality, and that when you go into depression, you know, that sense of mortality becomes overwhelming. And so that also is a dynamic that I think it's far more of an influence on the emotional, spiritual side than it is on the physical, material side.
Yeah.
Back to the question of how much we trust science. I know nothing about the follow-up on this sort of surgery, but apparently this discovery and the treatments are new enough that it wouldn't surprise me at all if 10, 15 years down the road we discovered that these preventive mastectomies
right.
expanded for the group as a whole life expectancy by 6 months or something.
Of course, there's always the possibility, and this is something that was hinted at here, is there's always the possibility that 30 years from now there will be a genetic treatment, you know, for that chromosome breakage, the gene breakage. So there's another sort of, you know, present concern and almost future hope. I mean, how do you balance hope here with present concern? There's risk there too. I mean, how do you find the balance between the two?
I'm kind of curious, and maybe this is a different tangent than you want to go, but you had heard yesterday you mentioned sin, and one of the things was foreknowledge, which kind of confused some people. And genetic testing gives us an element of foreknowledge, admittedly, maybe it's a ratio of a group, but it still is more foreknowledge. How do you work that together, or that's not where you want to go?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, part of the issue, I think, with genetic testing, and I'm sure all of us have. Has anyone seen the movie Gattaca? I mean, it's an interesting movie. I didn't think about bringing it up here. I should have. But, you know, the main character is going to die at the age of 30 of heart problems. And his older brother is genetically produced. And he's perfect, of course. But I think he dies. I haven't seen it in a while. I think he dies. And his brother, the one who's a natural birth, takes his place, even to the point of gluing his brother's fingernails patterns. So you saw a picture of him pressing up his finger out. He had his brother's fingernails like plastered on his fingernails, so he could get in. And he had to vacuum his computer every night because he wanted to go into outer space, and he wouldn't be able to pass because of the genetic testing. Genetic testing obviously offers us some degree of, here's potential, but it also gives us the possibility in the future to sort of get rid of all those diseases like diabetes, which to me raises a question, too, about, you know, are such illnesses as diabetes, and, you know, not trying to mitigate your experiences at all, but, I mean, if you value that all of us are equally endowed with the image of God, you know, autism, diabetes. Well, then, are those mistakes? Is there a mistake on God's part as creator? You know, it asks sort of this kind of question, you know, how much really is up to God? How much is up to us? You know, what's the relationship between God's intention for us? And is there a giftedness to those kinds of illnesses that ask all of us as Christians, for instance, to support and seek the end of suffering for those who do suffer? Partially, that's our calling.
On the other hand, you know, if you see a child in front of you dying of cancer and somebody comes up and says, this is God's will, you pretty much want to smack them.
Well, but there clearly are Christians. Right. I mean, right. The example I brought up yesterday, I suspect they, because they believe in faith healing, that if the child dies, it's God's will. That's a view, then, of how things work. Yeah?
Speaking of autism, does anybody who's older, like my manager or whatever, remember kids with autism when you were growing up? Were there any kids around that had autism 50, 60 years ago?
Yeah.
I think so, but they didn't call it that.
As many as now?
No, it's increased.
Because they've been diagnosed better.
Well, maybe there's something else going on in our environment or whatever that has goofed up our genetic pattern, or some people's genetic pattern.
Well, people are having children much later, and the risk of certain potentials increases. Autism is one of them, that as we diversify in the way, I suspect that childbearing was more focused in the young in earlier times, and that now it's not unusual for a 40-plus-year-old woman, even And so that, you know, human agency and divine agency do kind of connect in this. And so that it, you may say that it's God's will, but you certainly had a lot to do with it.
I think certain professions have a risk of goofing up your genes, like working with certain chemicals, for instance, can cause genetic.
Well, I think that's one of the elements of that lack of foreknowledge, that we don't know what's going to happen in the future. And 60 to 75% of the processed food we eat is made from genetically modified crops. Mm-hmm. And there are no long-term studies about what would happen to the human body, right, by eating those types of foods. But it's completely in our food supply.
What was your first statement? I didn't catch
that. 60 to 75% of the processed food we eat in this country,
okay,
is made from genetically modified crops.
Oh, okay.
And there are no scientific studies that sort of wonder about the long-term effects of eating genetically modified foods.
And then the question comes in, and I think this is similar to genetic testing, where do we place the, where do we place the ethical question? Is it the scientists who thought about, well, let's see if we can genetically modify this and make more food? Or is it in the capitalist production system that says, "Oh, we can do this. Let's mass produce this on a massive
sure.
scale. Let's feed cows chopped up cow brains. That'll be a great idea. And let's do it really, you know, on a massive scale." I mean, we push drugs onto the market like this to make a profit. I mean, it gets tricky between, well, should we just not explore anything at all because it might be misused, or you know that's an ethical question at
sure.
whole bunches of layers, or
sure.
could we actually science in its best wants probabilities and wants to keep testing and keep testing and keep testing and revising, and it's not a linear thing, it's always about revision. We just put things on the market super fast and don't let it get to that point. But so then where does the ethical issue lay? Is it with doing the experiments in the first place, doing the testing in the first place? Is it with how it's used? Is it how the medical profession pushes it? I mean, there's tons of layers of ethical
sure.
choices in here.
Where do you start? Yeah. You with your hand up, too.
Well, I keep thinking, historically, I mean, the Genome Project is what's in our faces right now, but historically, when Dr. Salk discovered the vaccine for polio, yes, were these questions being asked then? And you know, not to belittle that we're asking these questions, but in some sense, is it not progress that we keep coming around to these, you got to take risks to move ahead. And so maybe it's just built in, I don't know, I mean, in the Middle Ages, they used leeches of lead people, and we think
they're
that's
using
really,
them again now.
I know, we think it's really weird, but it's come back. So I don't know how to look at it completely, because long term.
Well, there are no easy answers. I mean,
we keep repeating ourselves.
Go ahead.
Well, isn't that kind of, I think, it's, is that not right? It's human nature. Like, you can't, people will always take risks and lift the crops and, you know, genetically modified, and people will start dying if it's not good for you, and then they'll go back and fix it. And isn't that how everything is? I mean, isn't that life? Isn't that how it goes?
I think if you have an assumption that culture progresses, and you also have a culture that's what human nature is. I mean, there are certain, you know, even sort of radical Buddhism in a lot of ways is to deny the world, close yourself off, because life in the material world is suffering. And why is suffering caused? Because you desire things. And when you desire things, you might attain some of them, but there will always be more desires. So what do? You remove yourself from the world of desires. That's a sort of a different view of human nature. Science, I mean, there's been lots. Islam had sort of, Islam until the 12th or 13th century were the preeminent scientists in the world. The West now has sort of taken that mantle over. And it's unclear what that means. Unclear of those sort of visions and values of our human. And I think Jenny, you bring up where you start. Okay.
Well, it just also seems like it's such a
And I mean, I guess it's the duh thing, but I mean, this is such a question of privilege too, and like, who even gets to, like, that we even get to ask these questions and get to find these things out is a very, you know, like, privileged,
sure,
high economic kind of decision. And in terms of like individual and communal, and like, is part of the ethical decision, like, should we even be getting to ask these questions and find these things out when many people in the world don't even have the vaccines? That, you know, like, is it ethically responsible of us to get to ask these questions if we haven't yet even dealt with the past, you know, polio? I mean, yeah, whatever. I mean, like, if we haven't even figured out that technology, like, is it ethically okay to move on to this technology if we haven't figured out how to fairly distribute that other kind? And so part of it is, I mean, yes, it is human nature to keep asking these questions, but is part of our duty also to to figure out healthy ways to have used the information that we have gotten before we pursue the next part of the information, I guess.
Our time's up, so I certainly, I'll answer any of the questions, but just to let you know, you don't have to say that you don't want to. So,
well, I'm still back on the theological stuff where I am. You know, I think the whole notion of, we're caught in this, we're going to do this no matter what. Human beings are going to continue to do things, and because of sin and unforeseen consequences, life is going to get messed up. But I think it's the misreading of the Christian church with that material, spiritual thing. I think Jesus did not come and say, our home is in heaven, and everything's going to be fine when we get there. I think Jesus came and proclaimed, the kingdom of God is present here and now, and how do we care for each other in the midst of the crap we have to live in? And how do we, because there is always going to be crap that we live in, and we can't get out of that. We can't expect God to come and just set everything right. That'd be beautiful. It ain't going to happen. Instead, how do we live the kingdom now? So how in the midst of our suffering, our midst of our pain, our midst of our brokenness, do we live out that image of God and accept and care for each other even though things are all messed up? And I think too often we shoot toward heaven, and I think that's a complete misreading of Jesus, and probably even of Paul. I don't think they were saying it's all about getting there. I think here is where we're supposed to be.
Well, I will point out that, you know, if you read the Bible sort of in its historical context, what do you think the average age of the person was in the first century Palestine? Life wasn't easy. So I think Kate's point in some ways reflects that we're sort of thrown into our contemporary culture, and our contemporary culture says, you know, physical life matters, and how long are we supposed to live? Men, what, 72, and ladies, 80? So there's an expectation that life is more than just 30 years and you die. You know, we have comforts. We have cable television, and or cable or dish, you know.
And some places, air conditioning.
And air conditioning. We live in a very comfortable society that values physical existence, and I don't think that was true 2,000 years ago. And I think the Bible, historically, comes out of a very different understanding of the value of the physical world.
Well, and it's been interpreted differently over the centuries, because there's the classic examples of the overlords, and many an age, saying, you know, sure, your life is crummy right now, but don't worry, just keep believing in your God, and it'll get better later. And people buying that, and suffering, you know. So it changes all the time, and there's, who knows, probably people who still believe that thing.
Well, then, for instance, anyone know anything about liberation theology, which is practiced in Latin America, which focuses on poverty and any poverty? It's sort of anathema to the Pope. The Pope has gone after them, even as a cardinal, because they emphasize the physical world over and above the end world of heaven. So there's, you know, Christianity is a massively complex religion, which, and it's, I think, even more so today because of sort of the parameters of theology are so broad. I mean, I come from a background theologically where we just argue, what is theology? We don't actually stand in it. It's all method and theories of doing theology, not you know, I didn't go to a Lutheran seminary, I went to a graduate program. So
this explains many things.
Should I end on that?